I personally am formerly incarcerated as a teenager. Definitely helped participate in poison in my neighborhood. Got a 24-year sentence, did 16 years, 8 months of that. Had a stroke and heart attack in the county jail. Was blessed to be saved. And from that point on, I got on my knees daily until I was released. I show up at church as much as I can, go to Bible study as much as I can.
This is Jen Slumack. You're listening to the podcast, Just Say It, a show that aims to highlight the commonplaces among us. As we amplify a variety of voices, conversations, and questions, we hope to make social constructs obsolete and move together toward Dr. King's beloved community. Thank you for tuning in.
I think one of the biggest problems that we've got is a lack of visibility of the human element. You know what I mean?
That's right. Yeah, people always running from them conversations. They know about it, but they run from them. I'm with you. Come on. We can talk about some of everything. It don't matter.
Well, then let's start simple. Just tell the audience who you are.
That's cool. My name is Charles Ryan. I'm a father, son, grandson, uncle.
The audio gets a little janky here, but suffice it to say that his list goes on. And among the things that he lists that he is, a little cousin, a big cousin, an American business owner, and a mentor.
I'm the owner of Chuck's Pressure Washing Service out of Antioch, California. I service the Bay Area, 50-mile radius from Antioch. I'm a certified mentor with M3, Mentoring's Men's Movement. The work that I do there is that I work with formerly incarcerated men and men that's on the inside, preparing them for coming home.
When Charles talks about the men on the inside, he's referring to those who are still incarcerated, those who are disconnected from their families and under the scrutiny of police 24/7. Why would he want to go back there after he's been freed from a system that is historically so violent and so hostile towards his humanity? And then I find myself up against the reality that men like Charles don't have a vastly different experience of their own humanity and what is just, even after he's been released. And I am forced to reflect upon the fact that we as a nation have failed he and others so profoundly that Charles doesn't want to go back to the prison or the jail that he left, but he's willing to. And he's willing to because somebody has to do the work of healing the harm that has been caused by racism in this country. Let him tell you.
A lot of them fathers in and out of jail or just on drugs or whatever, and they never had a male mentor. Me, myself, I love my father, but he wasn't a mentor to me. He taught me a lot of bad things. So, you know, through M3, I have four mentors, Mick Gardner, George Duran, Dr. Jones, and Floyd Johnson. All of them are the founders and chairman of M3. They work close with me. Anytime I have an issue where I know I might not be able to go to my father, I go to either one of them. All I do is pick up the phone and make the call. Also, I mentor about five guys that's incarcerated right now. All of them facing a lot of time. At the same time, I just want to make sure that they prepare for what they're about to go through and continue to do the work so they can be ready when they come home. I personally am formerly incarcerated as a teenager, did some harms growing up, definitely helped participate in poison in my neighborhood, got a 24-year sentence, did 16 years, 8 months of that. And then just recently in 2010, I got arrested for something that I had nothing to do with. Had a stroke and heart attack in the county jail, was blessed to be saved. And from that point on, I got on my knees daily until I was released. I show up at church as much as I can, go to Bible study as much as I can. But I continue to give back every day.
And I've seen that firsthand. I mean, Chuck and I met at an orientation for a new job that he and I would be in with the same company that provided educational services to those who are incarcerated and those who are recently released. So I've seen your commitment to men and women who have been through the things that you've been through. And one of the things that Chuck and I talk about frequently is the lack of understanding by the general public about the impacts of incarceration and how deeply such trauma finds itself in the fabric of families and DNA.
Exactly.
Okay, so you were saying that you mentor 5 men on the inside, right?
And I believe it's 11 that's on the outside.
A lot of people in the audience have no concept of the difficulty in reentering society after a time of having been disconnected from the family and in the community. I mean, they've had to go on without you. So how do you come back from that?
One of the biggest barriers is pretty much coming home and feeling wanted. You know, you get a lot of I love yous while you're on the inside, but when you come home and you're not working, you don't have money right now because people want you to instantly contribute to what's going on out here. It's a challenge for guys that have been participating in street life most of their lives. So the first thing that they want to do is run back to the old behaviors. One of my goals is to continue to challenge them to think about themselves first. Sometimes you have to be homeless. Sometimes you might have to go through them challenges, but you don't want to put yourself in a situation when you're back in jail. So getting them to go to different groups, staying connected to the people who was connected to them on the inside, utilizing all the resources that have been handed to them that they know about. And the first thing they got to remember is to make sure that they make the phone calls when they need help. Pretty much before I have offered a couch. You know, my mentors told me they wouldn't do that. But I know how challenging it is being formerly incarcerated that, you know, you don't want to be on the street. You definitely don't want to be asking people and feeling like you're a burden on them by just asking for a warm place to stay. So, I mean, don't have no place to go. I'm liable to get you off the street. But it's a give and take type of thing. I continue to challenge them to do the right thing, no matter how hard it is. You just got to do it. If you don't, incarceration is waiting for you. You know, man, we get to talk about numbers, and I get to whooping them on the numbers. You know, how much the system make on their presence being incarcerated compared to what they could do for themselves out here if they just challenge themselves.
And what kind of a response do you get when you present that to individuals?
Get a lot of tears. Get a lot of that's real talk. I never heard it like that before.
Why do you think the tears?
Because nobody ever cared enough about them to give it to them, you know, straight up. I mean, I've been in their shoes. I'm still challenged every day. But I'm blessed to have a support system around me to where I could lean on those individuals when I come up on challenges that I've never experienced before in my life. I was incarcerated pretty much most of my adulthood. So to come home, you know, in 2016 and said, you know what? I love everybody and I appreciate everything that y'all did for me, but let me show y'all that I'm serious about doing what I said I was going to do. I really fully believe that, you know, God did a lot in making sure that I stay focused and not allow old situations to cause me to revert back to old behaviors. I mean, I get challenged every day, Jen. I mean, business is good, but then sometimes it ain't as good as it should be, and bills still got to be paid. But at the end of the day, they can't take me to jail because I owe a few dollars, you know. And if I need to sit down for a minute and reevaluate how to go about getting a different customer or advertise a little bit differently, that's the challenge in it. And it makes me better for the next challenge that come ahead instead of worrying about what the court system want to do to me because I didn't do something. Yeah, it ain't worth it.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your relationships and whether it's just your relationships or even if you want to talk about the men that you mentor, the kinds of the impact that incarceration has on families. Can you give our listeners some insight on that from your experience?
I'm engaged to one of my mentees' mother. She was my first girlfriend, and this kid been through a lot of trauma. You know, I work with him all the time, and I keep it straight up with him just as if he's my own child. And he gets me, you know, he really gets me. He works hard to try to get it right, but still he's a youth that still make mistakes. Definitely a challenge for his family because they want him to do right, but they can't make him do right. He has to want it for himself. So I continue to challenge him in that way and constantly try to let the family know that, I mean, it's a messed up situation that, you know, they go through growing up. They have to trust somebody, and it's easier for them to trust an individual that's been through what they're going through right now.
Yeah. How about the connection or the disconnection that is created? I know that you've got children. When you came out, what was that reunification like? What was some of the things that your children struggled with and vice versa?
Jen, you asking good questions. So,
these are the bigger issues, right? This is what we see, Chuck, man. You know, when we go out there and we do our work with Ceasefire, we go out there, we do this peer support and all this stuff. We see all these men and women, but in my experience, a lot of the men from the inside coming out trying to find their place back in their families.
Exactly.
So tell us a little bit about that.
All right. So I was married when I came home in 2005. My older three were extremely juiced and happy to have their father home finally. Proceeded to continue to move on with my life, but take care of my responsibilities towards them. But I have two little girls today. And the older three became upset because they started seeing me doing things with the younger kids that they never had when I was incarcerated. What really hurt them the most is when I got grabbed in 2010. I mean, I could tell them all day long that I didn't do anything to be here, but not being there was a deal breaker, something that they really wasn't feeling. They didn't think they could trust me. It got bad. So being asked to do something that, you know, growing up from where I'm from, you just don't do.
What is that?
Telling. I could have gave somebody up the same day I was arrested, but I mean, you know, I was taught differently. I learned that your credibility in the streets was more valuable than me going to jail for a long time.
So, Chuck, I just want to pause there real quick because it's a lot of folks who I hope will listen to this, because I want people who aren't typically invested in, you know, this work to hear it and to listen and to learn. And so I want to stop there and just say that I think that's a really important point to highlight is in all of the information that we gather when we are making judgments about others. And in this case, folks who have been incarcerated or folks who have parents who have been incarcerated or children who have been incarcerated, whatever the case, we have these ideas that, well, then they shouldn't break the law. Well, then they shouldn't do this and they shouldn't do that. And sometimes the system is so janky. The system is so dysfunctional. The criminal justice system is so broken that there are times when a young man's, the way he was raised to have integrity, demonstrate character, to honor loyalties, be what he has learned it is to be a man, when those things come into play, and for instance, he doesn't tell, he could do an insane amount of time, and it happens all the time.
All the time, Jen. I mean,
the time.
Working with guys right now who really, if they would just eat their pride and get over that male role belief system, these guys were just around when situations happen. And they can't just say, that person did this, I didn't do it, because not only will their life be in jeopardy, but their family's lives would be in jeopardy as well. And it's something that's being taught in a lot of neighborhoods, especially where I'm from, even more so now because these young guys didn't have grown men in their lives to teach them differently. They was raising each other. Being a snitch and telling it's on a scale, you know. If you're a civilian and you don't participate in what's going on in the street, you telling ain't considered snitching. But if you are participant in what's going on the streets and you get caught up in something, you get that person up, that's snitching.
So what about the people who would say, well, why are you involved in the mess that you can't snitch about? Why are you in it?
9 times out of 10, it's being a product of your environment. You're around the people that you're around because this is where you're from. And today, a lot of the youth, they're unable to go outside their own neighborhood, so they're right there in the center of everything. I know a lot of kids that's born and raised in San Francisco but never seen past Bayshore, and they're from Hunters Point. It's like that throughout the city. I mean, it's dangerous out there just because they growing up in certain neighborhoods and trying to get them to understand. A lot of the funerals that's been happening in the past 10, 15 years, you see a lot of family members who didn't know that this kid was related to that kid. It just really destroyed a lot of things that I was taught when I was growing up.
So what do you think, in your experience, it's all about in terms of all of the guns, the homicides?
My philosophy on that is the video games. And I explain why. I don't know how to work the joystick, so I never got involved with the video. I was Atari baby.
Yeah, you and me are old, because a joystick is back in Atari days. They ain't had joysticks in about 2 decades. I think they're all buttons now.
But think about it, though, Jen. Most of the games that the kids play today, they're shooting games.
Yeah.
A lot of these games, you know, it's programmed in their minds that they kill to win points or get extra men, right? They get shot in the game, they can reset the game and restart the whole game. But when they get drunk or high or whatever it may be, when they're out there on the street and they knowing it's hot out there and it's a lot of shooting going on, they've been playing with it in video games, so why not test it out in the street? And when you shoot somebody in the street, you can't reset it. You get caught. You definitely have to deal with the consequences, but they not experienced to know what the consequences are because nobody has ever taught them that. And it's a shame, but I mean, in San Bruno and alone, I think 75% of those youngsters that's up there are up there for homicides. And a lot of them are looking at a lot of time, more time than they even been alive. And how can you tell a kid that you're looking at 50 years to life and you haven't even lived to be 25 yet?
You know, a lot of the men that I worked with when I went into San Quentin, a lot of these men were facing life for an awful lot of time for pulling a trigger when they were 17 or being in the car with somebody who pulled the trigger when they were 16 or 17 or whatever, facing an awful lot of time. And, you know, just by the mere fact of maturing, a lot of these men are able to see. A lot of the things... And this is just my opinion, but a lot of the things that we call criminal in poor neighborhoods or in communities of color are really, it's really adolescence in an environment that happens to be riddled with drugs, poverty, and guns.
Survival mechanisms inside the neighborhoods, but those survival mechanisms don't work in society. And when they take them outside the neighborhood and get caught up, it's like a deer in headlights. Wait a minute, I was taught to do it this way, but then I'm out here and I'm getting disciplined. And I don't know, Jen, I mean, it's a lot of work to be done. First of all, you know, men of color need to step up and show up. And it ain't about telling the kids or the young guys what to do, but show them how to do it. You know, you can't just tell somebody what to do and expect them to do it. If you show them a better way, I believe they'll probably pick it up, especially if they see the benefits of it.
What would you say to your 16-year-old self right now if you could? If you were able to go and speak to who you were at 15 or 16, what would the man you are today tell him?
All right. At 16 years
old. Yeah, think about it for a minute.
I mean, I know what I was doing at 16. I was at that in-between stage. I was playing basketball, football, and baseball at Woodrow Wilson in San Francisco. I also was selling weed. Mm-hmm. I had a nice car. I'm engaged to my first girlfriend who was here right now. So I was, you know, I was living that lifestyle where if I had an opportunity to talk to myself right now, coming from where I come, where I came from, basically putting in the work that I put in out there in the streets definitely ain't worth it. So as a 16-year-old, I would probably talk about my experience. You know what I'm saying? This is what I did at 16. I believe I did it just as good as anybody else probably have. I don't have no enemies in San Francisco. I've never killed anyone. I never did somebody so wrong to where they're looking for me right now today. While I was incarcerated, I'm one of them guys that all the guys looked up to. I just been like a stand-up guy the whole time, and I was trained that way by my father. But to be able to tell a 16-year-old, find something you're really good at and make it your own. Because at 49 today, and I just turned 49 last Friday.
Happy birthday.
If I would have thought that I could be the pressure washer that I am today at 16, I'm looking at, man, what, 33 years of work and towards family, you know, generational wealth. That's what I'm focused on. I had a mindset today that if I was 16, I definitely would do what I'm doing right now. I would tell me at 16, don't give up on your dreams. I wanted to be a basketball player. And I played baseball better than basketball. So I could have been a Deion Sanders. I could have been a couple of those dual sport players, because being 6'5" and playing baseball, having a gun, and then, you know, playing basketball, I shot threes. I mean, either hand.
What positions did you play? Were you forward?
I played two guard and I played point. Cool. I could dribble the ball pretty good.
Yeah.
Definitely could shoot. There's four guys that I played ball with. Gary Payton, Antonio Davis that played with Indiana Pacers, Byron Shaw that played with the Lakers and won a couple of championships. And we pretty much watched Jason Kidd grow up. So I played with quite a few guys that played in the NBA. I think I would have beat them all, though.
Yeah, that's the truth, man. That's how I am with folks who are doing comedy. It's like, you know, I used to share stage time with that fool. Now he's making movies. But you know what? You know what the reality is, though, man? I don't know. I mean, I guess we could always be a little disappointed in ourselves that we didn't follow through on some of that stuff that we had going for us for a minute. But, you know, I believe that God does what needs to be done in our lives to make us as useful as we need to be to do that work. And
exactly.
Man, if you were playing for the Lakers, I never would have met you probably. So I'm kind of selfishly glad that you're doing what you're doing.
Me too.
I'm not happy you had to go through what you had to go through, but I know that you have the capacity to affect a lot of men and help a lot of men. You said early on when we started talking tonight about talking with the men on the inside because they don't have males to speak to. One of the things we talked about at a restorative justice symposium at San Quentin one time was trying to get something like this video conference software inside of the prisons, so that men who are inside, who still have time to do, and then they could like go back to their communities and be the male adults with wisdom about how to love young men and how to guide young men, and have the young men come together in some sort of an assembly, right? And have dialogue with the men from their community that has been separated from their communities. Because you're absolutely right, man. It's like, they're raising each other, right? The children in these neighborhoods, they're raising each other. It's babies having babies.
And it was, let me tell you, it was all by design. You know, stuff didn't get dropped into the neighborhood because we was looking for it. It was dropped in the neighborhoods by design. So I grew up in that generation to where my grandfather bust his butt every day going to work. My father did too, but my father was that generation that got caught up with the stuff that came through the neighborhood. And me being his son, I took on the hustling part of it. So
daddy.
It separated three generations, and then look, we got another four generations coming up behind us that didn't have no grown men to look up to.
So you're talking about crack epidemic, yeah? In the 80s? Okay, were you staying in San Francisco, Oakland?
I was staying in Oakland, but I was in the city probably every day.
Okay.
As a kid, you go stay with your mom, man. My mom stayed in Oakland, but every day or every weekend, I was in Hunters Point with my pop and the rest of my family.
Okay, two things. Number one, you spoke of generational wealth, which is something a lot of people aren't aware of, lacking.
Not even thinking about it.
Not even on the radar, man, but that's something that I think you can maybe educate us on here in a second. And also the fact that grandpa worked his ass off, daddy worked his ass off, and then, you know, this bright, shiny object gets pulled into the neighborhood and everybody starts going a little off with it. And by a generation into that, we've got a daddy in jail, and then we've got a young man without a father, and here we go, right? Anything you can say about either of those to expand on it, to kind of illustrate it, would be, I think, helpful.
I'm crazy about my pop. I mean, Jen, you see me on Facebook, and anytime I'm with my pop, I'm always hanging out with him, taking pictures. He my hero, no matter what he's been through or what he's ever done. I got a lot of whoopings that I didn't deserve. And I don't hold him accountable for that. You know, I have a theory of why he always came through to probably discipline me, because he still loved my mom. So, but I mean, it's neither here or there. One thing for certain is when my father lost his father, I believe this was, my grandpa passed away right before my 11th grade year. So this had to happen in 1985, my grandfather passed away, his father. And my grandmother had told him, and my father left the house. And as soon as I came in from school, like, I ride a bus that passed by my grandfather's house, and I seen an ambulance, but I never once thought anything wrong. So once I got home, my grandmother told me to go find my father, because she told me my grandfather passed and she was worried about him. So I instantly go look for him. I can't find him. And then he come back in the house later on and he looked like he was lost. And from my understanding and from him sharing with me is that as soon as he found out that his father lost, he just went and got high. And from that day forward, it's been like a snowball effect. It's just been like he was going a direction I've never seen my father go in. He always been that strong macho dude. He always been working. And so that bothered me big time. It was a time where I asked him to buy me some shoes. This is the turning point with me. I'm an honor roll student. I'm playing sports. I help out around the house. I'm everything that you would want your son to do. And I asked him to buy me some shoes that Patrick Ewing used to wear in 85, called them Georgetown Hoyas.
I remember those.
Within $25, all my friends had some. My father's a carpenter, and I watched him get his checks cashed, so I knew he had the money. He paid every week. I asked him to buy me the shoes. The guy told me to get a job and start hustling. All right, so I thought about it.
Who told you that? Who told you to get a job?
My father. He told me, get a job and start hustling. And from what I've been seeing growing up in my neighborhood, the hustling was the family business.